In 2018, the Women in Leadership Project has teamed up with the Mennonite Inc. to produce Holding It Together. Today you're listening to the beginning of something new. In 2018, the Women in Leadership Project has teamed up with the Mennonite Inc. to produce Holding It Together, a podcast that will delve into the lives and experiences of women and some men across Mennonite Church USA. We'll connect with people from all over the country, folks living into the fullness of who God created them to be, people stepping out in faith and standing in their conviction, individuals who are doing their best, one day at a time, to love God and neighbor, midwifing new systems and new ways of being in the world. The people we feature in our stories and interviews are like you and me, people who daily encounter mundane responsibility, joy, and struggle, imperfection in the midst of high aspirations, accomplishment, and disappointment. Too often in the context of faith and lived experience, the stories we tell are stories of overcoming, of success, of all that is waiting on the other side. Here on this podcast, we want to notice the beauty of the process, to paint pictures of authentic people and whole people. Here, we recognize that to live out our convictions and co-create new ways of being in the world, we need one another. We need each other to hold together with us all that we carry in our journey of becoming. We need each other to bear witness to the process. Because, yes, some days we do shine. We are successful beyond our wildest imaginings. But most days, we're just holding it together. Hi, and welcome to the first ever episode of Holding It Together, a joint production of the Women in Leadership Project and the Mennonite Inc. I'm Jenny Castro. I'll be your host for this experiment. So a little bit about how Holding It Together will work. For each series, we'll choose a theme and delve into that theme from all different angles, using a few different lenses. Each episode will have its own style and approach. Some episodes will feature a compelling article or an essay and an interview with that author. Sometimes we'll invite a panel for discussion. Recognizing that some people feel more comfortable with close friends and family, some episodes will be friends and family interviews, where I'll hardly talk at all, opening up space for people who know each other really well to dig into their stories. We'll also have talkback episodes, where folks are invited to submit a response to a question related to the series theme. So, with that, let's get started. Our theme for this inaugural series is Women in Leadership. Being the Women in Leadership Project, we thought it was an apt jumping off point. So over the course of the next few episodes, we'll get to know women who've been called to leadership. We'll explore the questions they encounter regularly and talk about challenges they face every day. We'll hold their stories and celebrate the movement of the Spirit through them in the world. In thinking about where to begin this series on women in leadership, I decided to start with the personal. I want to ground our conversation over the next few weeks in real life and real experience. I have come to believe that talk and theorizing can only go so far if we don't understand how our theories impact people, if our analysis is purely a head exercise. So today, on Holding It Together, we've got a conversation between Michelle Armster, Executive Director of MCC Central States, and Iris Delun Hartshorn, Director of Transformative Peacemaking for MCUSA.
I loved my job. I really loved it, and I really grew a lot.
I think that was the job that helped you to see your gifts and strengths as a leader, as a woman of color in leadership. I think it was a job that helped you to kind of find your voice and own your voice, speaking your mind even if your voice shakes.
These women have been friends for nearly 30 years. And as women of color, they've worked for that long in a very white Mennonite world. As a woman of color myself, I'm sometimes overwhelmed by the culture shock I experienced in Mennonite spaces. And so I was eager to sit and listen to the wisdom of these sages. And I'm delighted to share their conversation with you today.
I imagine people would want to know how we first met, Ira. So what do you remember?
Well, we were both in Western District. You were going to the Peace Church in Dallas. I was at the Houston Church. And I think we met because our churches always did things together, like either the relief sale or the retreat. I visited your church a few times. So I think, you know, we met that way early on, probably in the late 80s. That's what I remember when we first met.
That's what I recall. It was the late 80s, and I'd heard your name quite a bit. But I think what I recall also is when I started working for Mennonite Central Committee in 1999 and moved to Mennonite Central Committee in Akron, that's when I think we really got to know each other more, because we were around, we knew each other beforehand. Because it was as if we were the only two women of color in the whole Mennonite church in Texas. And so we felt in some of the settings we were in is like, okay, which is not true, because the reality is there's a large number of Latino churches in Texas that are Mennonite church, but seemed like the circles that we found ourselves were quite different. So yeah, I remember 1999, and I think you were the one who probably, what do you call it, suggested me for the position. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I remember we were getting names for mediation, and I knew that you had done mediation work, and we were really working hard to have a diverse pool of people to interview. So I was really glad when you said yes, you would come. But I also was afraid you probably wouldn't take the job because, well, you know, living in Dallas, like I lived in Houston, and then you come to live in Lancaster or even Akron, where, 3,000 or 4,000 people? I mean, it's kind of a shock.
Yeah, you talk about a cross-cultural experience. Oh, my Lord. So in spite of all that, I did move to Lancaster. So we lived on the same block, and I think that was also how we got to know each other better.
Spending holidays.
and what have you. And,
well, you became a part of our family.
So that's how that all happened. So I think we've known each other for at least 30 years.
So, but, I mean, what drew you to take the job?
You know, at that time, I was living in Dallas. I had been in the insurance industry for close to 20 years. I was an insurance claims examiner. I had been very active in the local peace center as well as local conflict resolution center as a volunteer. And, you know, ironically enough, the year before I'd been going through this personal journey of, you know, I found a book called Do What You Love and the Money Will Follow. And so I was doing that kind of journaling on, like, what is it that, you know, because what I'm doing, it's not that I hate it, but it's not feeding me. And it would be disingenuous to say it was bad because it paid very well, you know. So, yes, I was really going through a struggle, but I had grown weary because I'd been in for a number of years and it was changing quite significantly. And I was approached. Now, I think 2 years earlier, I had been approached, but I wasn't ready then. I'd been approached to work for MCC. The second time, it resonated more. After the interview and after I came back, I called my mom and I told her what was going on. And she said, so when are we moving? And I said, well, I need to pray about it first. She goes, okay. You pray and then just let me know when you're moving.
Sounds like your mom.
So, okay, and so, you know, Mary told Jesus, look, you go over there and make that wine for these people. So mother's got it like that. So packed all my, decided, packed all, got a blessing from my church, Peace Mennonite, and packed all my stuff and my cat and a U-Haul, and my mother and I drove across country to Lancaster, and moved into a place sight unseen. Yeah. So some people called it crazy. Some people called it an act of faith, you know, take it. Yeah. So how did you, how did you get from Houston to MCC?
Leo was ready to enter a D-Men program at Austin Theological Seminary. The church had voted that I would start as a co-pastor for, I can't remember, quarter or half time or whatever time, so that Leo could have time off. But before that, I had worked as a chaplain for hospice. We were just going to make that transition, and I get a call from, I think it was Tobin Miller Shear, called, and he says, hey, this job is open, wondering if you'd be interested in applying. So he sends all the stuff to me, and I'm looking at it, and of course, it's like, you know, Director of Peace and Justice, it's like a dream job. I've been involved with Peace and Justice for such a long time, and I thought, wow. I said, well, I wonder why they want me to apply. And, you know, first it's like, I'm suspicious. What's going on? So, you know, they were talking to me that they were really working at being anti-racist, and they really wanted to broaden the pool. And then I felt guilty because Leo had said yes to this D-Men program, and he really wanted to go. We had made this arrangement with the church, even though it wasn't effective yet, but Leo encouraged me to at least go and do the interview and see what happens. So I did. I went for the interview, and then I had heard, you know, that there were quite a few other people that applied for that position. And I just thought, I'm just never going to get it because I just don't have those connections. I was on the MCC Central States Board. That was my connection with MCC. And then my connection with Tobin and Regina was that I was on the Damascus Road team for Western District. I went and, you know, I got really excited, and but I just really didn't think they would offer it to me. And then when they did, that was a dilemma. But I have a really wonderful, supportive husband. And I remember we had moved several times for him, for jobs in churches for him. And he said he would be willing to move for me for this job if I really wanted it. And I said, okay. And it was tough because that's, two of my kids were in junior high. So, you know, they were hating me at the moment. It was a tough move for the family in many ways. I loved my job. I really loved it, and I really grew a lot.
I think that was the job that helped you to see your gifts and strengths as a leader, as a woman of color in leadership. I think it was a job that helped you to kind of find your voice and what that, you know, what that looks like, and own your voice, speaking your mind, even if your voice shakes, you know, and so your voice began to shake less and less, you know. So I mean, I just saw that very clearly in that role as Peace and Justice Director, whereas, you know, it was like, well, who else could have done it? It just, it was kind of a no-brainer. So I really did see personal, spiritual, and professional growth happening in that position, which I think prepared you for the one that you're in now in a really significant way.
Can choose to be chosen too, 'cause that's my decision, that's my religion, it's my decision, it's my religion.
We had a lot of good experiences. I mean, you and I especially working MCC. Many times I think of it as a gift that we were given. It's strange because when I think about this whole thing about privilege, this is something maybe white Mennonites kind of expect that they're entitled to.
Yeah.
And so like when you and I got to go, let's say, to Africa and other places, for us, it was a gift.
Yeah.
There is no way we would ever had those experiences, gone to those places.
Had the opportunities. There's no way we would have had it.
Yeah. No. And I remember when we were in Africa, some guy there We were at the UN Racism Forum in Durban, and it was a white Quaker that came up to us, and he saw that we had Mennonite Central Committee on our badge, and he said, "Oh, you work for Mennonite Central Committee?" And we said, "Yes." We said, "Yeah, and, you know, we're Mennonite." And he questioned us. Remember, he said, "Mennonite?" He goes, "Mennonites are white."
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, it was like, well, no.
We're standing right here in front of you.
You're standing.
Yeah. I mean, that just reflected who was allowed to go to these overseas experiences and who, I mean, I remember when we were in, every time we went any place where there were, in the case of being in Africa, where there were African people, they were dumbfounded. They were shocked that we were people of color, that Conrad and I were black, and that we came from this organization that they worked for. Then they had never seen a black person who worked for that organization there. And
right.
So it was a privilege and a responsibility. I think we, all three of us, felt that responsibility on what does it mean for us. And I would say for me as a woman of color, of African descent, to be privileged enough and gifted enough to go to the continent of Africa, let alone the emotional, how emotional it was for me. But, you know, what does it mean for me to go? And how do I tell that story? And it was a challenge. It was a challenge. But it's one of those gifts. Like, I agree with you, Iris. It was a gift that I would not have been able to do. And I think our experiences there were quite broad.
I don't know if the word is happy, but, well, I guess, you know, happy for you and Conrad was when you guys were able to attend the welcoming of the ancestors and the welcoming of Pan-Africans throughout the world, that Africans were apologizing for your ancestors being taken as slaves and where you ended up. Remember, you guys came back just so...
It was probably the most moving experience I've ever had in my life, where it was welcoming home those of us of the diaspora, and it was at the water's edge where enslaved Africans were taken by, you know, by ship and boats, and there were Africans of the diaspora from all over were there, and I remember sitting looking out at the water and sitting next to a woman. You know, and I'm looking at her thinking, you know, she could be a relative of mine, but we can't speak to each other. I think she was from Brazil. I do not speak Portuguese. And you know, and I'm from U.S. and she does not speak English. But we sat there holding hands. And they had a drum, and Conrad sat there and drummed. And then there were indigenous dancers and indigenous ceremony. And I'm telling you, that was probably the most powerful experience in my whole life. It continues to be a defining moment for me in my life, both spiritually, mentally, emotionally.
That's my religion. That's my decision. Yeah, that's my religion.
So Iris, when you were young, did you imagine that you would be doing the work that you're doing now?
No, not this, no. I imagined, I at a pretty young age, I think like 19, I did feel called, but I didn't know to what. I remember as a youth saying, I really feel called to the ministry. And I remember this older gentleman, it was in a Presbyterian church, came up to me and he said, well, God's calling you to the mission field. And I remember thinking to myself, no, I don't think that's what I heard. I mean, you know, he was thinking of, you know, overseas. And I just never had that. Mine was more local, more hands-on in the sense of my own community and the injustices that I saw in my own community. So I knew it wasn't that, but I wasn't sure what it was. I did CPE. I started seminary thinking maybe pastorate, even though I like pastoring and I enjoy that. I realized that has to be kind of a co-pastor for me. And I think that that's where Leo and I probably have our strengths because we're so opposite. And so that works out good for us. But all on my own, I don't think I would like to do that. But I like what I do. It's just so many different things. It's never the same.
And there's still elements of being a pastor or being pastoral in your work, which helps to kind of touch that,
right.
that piece of you.
And I think the other thing for me is that it's about not just the change that happens you want in your own community or in your church. It's also about the change that happens within you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I've learned some hard lessons, and I think I don't want to get mushy. I think Michelle really helped me through some hard times.
There has been hard times, I think, for both of us. And I am just so grateful that Iris is here and in my life, because there have been times for both of us where we're the church, we're church people, we're church institution. I felt like cannibalized our souls and our spirits in ways that the only way that we continue to stay is because we have relationships that we can call and tell, and we know it's going to stay there, and we can call each other and talk each other off the ledge, because we also have personal lives too that are greatly impacted. Iris was the person who introduced me to womanist. I understood that my theology, you know, like my Anabaptism ain't the Anabaptist. My Mennonite ain't the Mennonite. But I've been like, but I didn't have the articulation for how I understood what it means to be a follower of Jesus. That just wasn't quite the way it's being conveyed. And Iris was the one that gave me the book, Daughters of the Wilderness by Dolores Williams. And I read that book, and it was spiritually life-changing for me. After that, I was reading everything. I just was like, this is my voice. This is my lens on Anabaptist Christianity. And so I am eternally, eternally, eternally grateful to her for that, recognizing that I think you're missing something, but I think this will give it to you. And it did. And those are the things that we do for each other, because we're not always affirmed. And we're not always affirmed as women of color, in who we are, where we are, and what we do. But that's why it's important for us to affirm each other. If we need affirmation, we just need to go to each other, because if we're going to wait for it, it's not going to happen. You know, I think some people view the two of us in our positions. One, they think it was a affirmative action, and the others see it as it's because they are, you know, women, and because they are a person of color, as if we aren't qualified, and as if anybody else had been in the position before us was qualified. To be honest, we find ourselves coming into situations and jobs where they're in crisis. And it's like, well, we're in crisis. Who do we call? And, you know, and we call the women, and we call the women of color to come in. And we do. We do, and we do it well. And I'm not bragging. For me, as a womanist, I see leadership as not this either-or paradigm. It's a both-and. It's about the individual and the collective. It's, you know, and it's about the health of the entire community, and it's about affirming but also holding people accountable. And so it's both and also encouraging people, but also realizing I can't do it all. I don't know how to do it all. I will find the people who know how to do it, and I will be forever grateful. I will let them know, and I will let you know that it's that person there, that it's not me. I'm not going to take credit for something that it's, you know, somebody else's gifting. And that idea of the community is beyond ourselves. I don't have to do it by myself. I've got Iris and other sisters that we call each other, and that's what gives us the moorings, you know, the firm foundation. Yeah, that kind of thing.
You know, if I had to say what lesson have I learned, I grew up fairly independent, but I've realized you can't do it alone. You can't do this work alone. You can't really be a disciple alone,
amen.
Especially if you take being a radical disciple seriously.
Amen.
That can't be done alone.
Amen.
When things are just going bad, I mean, I can call Michelle. I don't have to worry about having some kind of introduction to what I'm going to say. I can just say it, and she knows where it's coming from. She understands it. But, you know, she had said earlier, you know, it's not just our work life, but, you know, our family life. And I really struggled with two of my children, but one of them mainly who was a drug addict. It was very tough for me. And I remember Michelle never judged me as a mother, never. Even though in my mind I would know what I needed to do, but I just couldn't do it then. I mean, like, you know, one of the things is, you know, you can't rescue them, but your instinct as a mother is to rescue. So sometimes I tell Michelle, well, this is happening. And, you know, she said, well, you know what you need to do. And I'd say, yeah. And I'd say, yeah, I need to do this, but I can't. I can only do this. I remember, Michelle, as you always said to me, that's okay. You can only do what you're able to do right now. That just gave me the strength to say, you know what? I can take this step right now. I don't have to take 10 steps. And that being a mother or being whatever, it's a journey. It's a process. I mean, I just feel like I can call you. You never judge me, no matter what crazy thing I'm in the middle of, whether it's my family or my work. Because, you know, in our mind, there's lots of times we know what the better way to go, but sometimes you aren't ready to go there. You don't have the strength or you don't have the emotional fortitude to do it at that time. And it's good to have a friend to say, that's okay. Do what you can and just keep going.
So what has brought you joy as a woman in leadership? And what is it that you believe that you bring as a Latina?
I think what brings me joy is when I've been able to walk alongside and bring other people of color in. Because if you've been lucky enough to you know, work in an organization like we did, I mean, with MCC and the work we do now, and then people I've seen in the past would say, well, I made it, but good luck everyone else. For me, it's about, no, how many more can I bring on this journey with me? How many more people of color can we have in leadership in the church to help the church truly be who God has called us to be?
Amen.
The diversity and the gifts that people bring. And I think all the different cultures bring different gifts. For me, you know, it's relational. I like to be with people. I like to relate to people. I don't mind being in front of people, but that's not my big thing. That's why I think I prefer to be doing trainings and teaching, because that's more interactive and more with people than standing up and preaching or I mean, I can do it, but that's not, I don't think that's my biggest gift. So I think as a Latina, I mean, I think there's many things. I think a lot has to do with just relationships and with family. That family is part of who I am. I mean, like sometimes I work with people in, I never hear them talk one word about their family. And I remember when I first went to work for MCC, I'll never forget my first day. I walked in and the receptionist said hi. And then I knew where my desk was going to be because I had visited. And I started to walk down the aisle. Everyone was at their computer. No one turned to say hi. Yeah. No one did anything. They were just like glued to their computer doing their work. Now, I mean, I'm not against work. But
that's a higher value is what you're saying.
That was the higher value, was to get that work done. Mm-hmm. When I first went, I started to start my morning by stopping off at everybody's desk and just saying, hi, how are you? You know, how's your family? And then I got feedback that apparently that was annoying because I was interrupting their work. And then, you know what? I just decided myself, I said, you know what? That's too bad. Because work is important, but relationships is also important. And I'm just going to be who I am, and I'm going to care about people and care about not just the work that they do, but also about their families and their life. I was, I guess, lucky. And like when Leo was going to seminary or going to school, one thing is he never left me out. All the stuff he was learning, all the latest books, all this. I mean, he's the one that introduced feminism, mujerista, womanist, all of that. He would bring books or tell me, read this, read that. So by the time I got to MCC, I had all this wealth of information. I mean, I had a library of resources. And someone said, well, how did you know about this stuff? It was because Leo brought me along as he went to school. And I think that, again, that was another thing. It's not stuff that you want to hog for yourself and only you have that knowledge or only you have that information. I want everyone to have that information. You know, I don't know directly, is it, I think it has to do with probably my culture, Latina culture, in the sense of, you know, community and what really means to be community. It's integrated. It's not just my family or just my work or just whatever, but it's all together. But what about you, Michelle?
I would say I think what has brought me joy has been the relationships that I have developed over the number of years. I see that part of me, because I'm a woman of African descent living in America and single. So I'm not physically close to family. I am now more so than, and so that's been good. But just having a community that's larger and broader than blood over the years has brought me joy. So watching people's kids grow up and graduate or not graduate, you know, walking alongside with people who's, you know, have struggles with children or with their own health, watching people being walking alongside people who are having grandkids, and I'm just inserting myself as Tia, DT, auntie, whatever I want to be, that has given me joy in really authentic ways. So, and I think my capacity to do that really is how I understand leadership as well, how I and what I bring as a woman of African descent, the understanding that the Ubuntu, that I think of Ubuntu, I am because we are, and we are because I am, that it's not either or, it's both and I tend to, I hope, that's what I try to do, is try to encourage people and say, oh, yes, you can do this, or because I don't believe that I empower anyone. I believe that the power is within them, and my role in life is to help them find that power within them. I'm not the empowerer. So those are gifts, I think, that are, as a womanist, I know it comes, and but I also even think there are times when I think of it in terms of as women of color who, although we are at the center, we still are on the margins. And so it's a perspective. I think we bring a perspective to a situation, to an organization, to a challenge. And I think that perspective is valued and is valuable. Anymore, I just feel like, you know what, I used to just get so, they are not listing those, you know, whatever's, and now I'm just like, you know what, I'm a woman over 50, more of my life is behind me than is in front of me, so I'm just going to say what I have to say. I know it's brilliant, and it's up to you whether you want to do it or not. I've lived, so that's my attitude.
I think aging, it frees you.
Amen. A lot of ways. Amen.
I think it gives you permission. And, you know, in some ways, authority in the sense of, if you think of elders or whatever, exactly. Even though I don't like to think of myself in that way.
I know, if we're honest, that's the truth, yeah.
You know, but, yeah, I've come to realize that that's kind of a increasing role, whether you kind of want it or not, and then being as responsible as you can. I don't have all the answers, and sometimes I have more questions than I have answers. One of the best things that happened to me was growing up Catholic, because I grew up with the understanding of mystery, that I don't have to know everything about God.
Amen. Amen.
I will never know everything about God. And you know what? That's okay. And I think sometimes, I think that's one of the pieces of the Anabaptist story that got thrown out during the Reformation, which I think we need. Because when you know that God is a mystery, when you know you will never figure out everything about God, it really centers you of who you really are in relationship to God. You are not the creator.
Preach! Preach!
You are a creation of God.
Great.
So for me, I mean, I always tell people I'm a real Anabaptist because I was Catholic and then I got rebaptized. I think that that is one of the pieces that is important. I think that's what keeps us humble. And yeah, and not with this idea that you're going to fix everything and you know it all. I mean, I really realize I really can't fix anything. I can walk the journey. I can do what's best and then allow God to work through me. But I am my own power by myself. No.
I always said, I'm so glad I'm not God, and you should be too. It's all about the grace. It's all about the grace, and I'm just so grateful for the grace. We need to bring some grace back to Anabaptism, and I think that's where I mean, not all, not everyone, you know, but I think for communities and people of color, that understanding of Anabaptism or see Anabaptism with a grace component is so, it is one of those things I think is different. You know, we can read the same thing, but understand it quite differently. And this idea of grace, I mean, it's stronger or not the same.
So. Yeah, there's that poem by Oscar Romero, Master Builder.
Yes,
and it's a poem, and basically he says, we are not the master builder.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We are the builders, but we are not the master builders. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We build for God. And it's this whole poem. And I love that poem. Mm-hmm. I wish I would have brought it with me. But anyway, it's a great poem.
Hi, it's Jenny again. I want to close out the show today with the poem that Iris mentioned at the end of their conversation. A Future Not Our Own is the poem often attributed to Archbishop Oscar Romero of El Salvador, but was actually written by Bishop Ken Untner for a homily by Cardinal John Dearden in November 1979 for a celebration of departed priests. A Future Not Our Own. It helps now and then to step back and take the long view. The kingdom is not only beyond our efforts, it is beyond our vision. We accomplish in our lifetime only a fraction of the magnificent enterprise that is God's work. Nothing we do is complete, which is another way of saying that the kingdom always lies beyond us. No statement says all that could be said. No prayer fully expresses our faith. No confession brings perfection. No pastoral visit brings wholeness. No program accomplishes the church's mission. No set of goals and objectives include everything. This is what we are about. We plant the seeds that one day will grow. We water the seeds already planted, knowing that they hold future promise. We lay foundations that will need further development. We provide yeast that produces effects far beyond our capabilities. We cannot do everything, and there's a sense of liberation in realizing this. This enables us to do something, and to do it very well. It may be incomplete, but it is a beginning, a step along the way, an opportunity for the Lord's grace to enter and do the rest. We may never see the end results, but that is the difference between the master builder and the worker. We are workers, not master builders, ministers, not messiahs. We are prophets of a future not our own. I want to thank Iris and Michelle for their generosity in coming on the very first episode of Holding It Together. I want to thank Addie Lichty, whose original music was featured on the show today. To find more music by Addie, look for Addie and the Subtracts on Facebook or Addie Lichty on YouTube. Holding It Together is a joint production of the Women in Leadership Project and the Mennonite Inc. Look for us on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you prefer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
I have found my decision. Some might say I found religion. It's the part you find after collision. not sad, but I won't use hate to say.